Welcome to the Muscle Expert Podcast with Ben Pakulski, one of the world's top professional bodybuilders, an expert on human performance and mindset mastery. Ben dives deep to deliver the strategies of the top experts to upgrade your body, mind, muscle, strength, performance, biochemistry, and how to become the upgraded modern man. Join us on BenPakulski.com to learn the cutting-edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? Ben Pakulski, the Muscle Expert Podcast. Today, we're going to dive deep on supplements. So we're going to focus on staying really, really tight around nootropics, dispelling the myths, looking at which ones actually work and which ones have scientific data. And our guest today, Curtis Frank, is a lead researcher at Examine.com. And you may know him from Reddit as Silvahydra. And if you want to check him out, you can definitely find him on social media and on Reddit. Curtis, welcome, man. I'm glad to have you.
Glad to be here. Just to clarify, I'm on temporary leave from Examine because okay. I'm temporarily – right now I'm working with Legion Athletics, and Examine's entire thing is being as unbiased as possible, so I can't really double dip for both companies, if you know what I mean.
I know you've got a huge presence on Examine, and that's where we found you. And you know, looking through all the contributions you had on there is absolutely massive, so I'm very grateful to have you and your brain be able to educate us. So getting into the topic of discussion today, dispelling the myths of nootropics and really getting to people understand. And, you know, there's so many companies out there trying to dive into this pre-workout / nootropic trend. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions, misnomers, and misunderstanding as to, you know, what works, what doesn't. And is there contraindications when combining, you know, 10 different types of nootropics? So I want to get into that a little bit and get your general feeling on the efficacy of nootropics and then diving into some specific ingredients.
Okay, so the entire field of nootropics right now is definitely in its infancy. We don't even know every aspect of the brain. There's just so much stuff that blindsides us. So when we know so little about the brain to then try to influence it with different herbs and supplements, it's a real mixed bag. But that being said, like, it has great potential. It's just you have some companies doing one thing, other companies doing the other, each saying that theirs is better for your brain and not really clarifying what they mean by good for your brain.
So getting into specifics of products, I know you've mentioned there's a few that you're really, really big fan of. The one that comes to mind first off is carnitine. And I know carnitine is one of those molecules that's, you know, there's many different types, there's many different isomers, I guess, and each of them can subjectively influence different tissues in the body. Any feedback and insight as far as what research you've pulled on acetyl L-carnitine and its influences on nootropic performance?
So I want to quickly make a differentiation between acetyl L-carnitine, or Alcar, as I'm going to call it henceforth, and every other variant of carnitine. Like, put Alcar on one side, put all the other variants just on the other side. When we look at the other things, they are, for the most part, useless unless you are a vegan or over the age of, like, 70 or 80.
Useless altogether, no performance benefit whatsoever?
There might be a performance benefit, but when it comes to the brain, specifically, they don't do much. But veganism, as well as just being really old, are basically states where carnitine stores are low in the body. So you can argue it has an almost vitamin-like effect in them. And especially for L-carnitine, L-tartrate, LCLT in particular, there is definitely performance benefits associated with that. But again, they usually manifest when the body's undergone stress, which normally uses up carnitine. But when it comes to the brain specifically, they're not going to do much unless something has made you relatively deficient. When it comes to Alcar in particular, it acts in a different manner. It could potentially increase the amount of glucose a neuron chooses to consume, which sort of hints that it's making the neurons work more. Whether it's good or bad in the terms of working more is not really proven. We don't have like studies that basically say take Alcar, memory increases. It just has really good theory. And when people take Alcar, they feel a sort of stimulation that's unlike any sort of like amphetamine or yohimbine-based stimulant, which if you take too much, you get the jitters. People report Alcar is a bit cleaner in the energy department.
And do you know the mechanical pathway of that?
I honestly think, to be honest, I don't know the actual molecular pathway leading to why Alcar is perceived as a mild stimulant. It is probably related to that, as I mentioned earlier, helping neurons just consume more glucose. Okay. As whenever you see things that are just bioenergetic in nature, help cells work better. So PQQ or pyrrolidine, quinoline, quinone, coenzyme Q10, acetyl L-carnitine, maybe even alpha-lipoic acid. These things are unreliable as stimulants, but when people report stimulation, they always seem to report that cleaner energy. Mm-hmm. So there's just a potential link with make cells work better, you feel a bit better. Right. But it's not something to put your faith into. But it's not like if you want to test it out for memory and it doesn't work, at least you feel a bit better. So silver lining.
Good. So I think even before diving into, you know, the supplements specifically, we should kind of pull back a little bit and get people to understand what exactly you're trying to do when you go into the gym or when you're trying to improve your brain function from a molecular perspective and neurotransmitter perspective. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what you know about dopamine and acetylcholine and how they work and what their primary purpose is in the body?
Okay, so I actually have a unique perspective on this when it comes to nootropics. Because, like, let's just use acetylcholine as an example. Acetylcholine tends to mediate both muscle contraction and some forms of learning. And so if you're able to increase acetylcholine by using something like alpha-GPC or huperzine A, you will be a bit stronger and potentially, you could argue, a bit smarter. And like in some of our products at Legion where we use alpha-GPC, people just report that like the mind-muscle connection they say is better and like no evidence to suggest if cholinergics do that. But, you know, if something mediates muscle contraction and learning, potential link, it's interesting to think about.
I totally agree.
But my perspective on this stuff is you try not to mess with neurotransmitters too much, or at the very least, when you do, you respect them afterwards. Sure. Like the catecholamines in particular, dopamine, adrenaline. Obviously, if you take a stimulant, it does stimulant-like things. And if you use it correctly, it can greatly benefit you. But if you use that 24/7, it's going to like hit you back and it's going to hit you hard. So you're basically on something and then you're off it. Every neurotransmitter theoretically could have that exact same rule, where if you play with it a little bit, you can exert benefits in the short term, but you need to like only take a supplement that's in your body for like, say, 2 or 3 hours. And then the other 20 hours, you're just having food sort of thing.
So
when I look at, when I look at nootropics, I categorize them into things that induce an effect, which would be anything that influences neurotransmitters, and things that have more vitamin-like motifs where if you're deficient, like carnitine, an example, if you're deficient, it will do things in your body up to a certain point, and your body decides that point and it will not go any higher.
Understood.
And yeah, those are the, generally speaking, they're a bit safer. Like the theory definitely implies that they're a lot safer, but again, not the best evidence on some of these nootropics.
Understood. So from my experience, I mean, I could be completely wrong on this. It seems as though most nootropics are working on inducing some type of effect. A lot of them are dopaminergic. A lot of them are, you know, increasing acetylcholine. So talk about, you know, the difference there. So obviously the vitamin effect, which ones are we looking at from your perspective that have, you know, quote unquote vitamin effect, meaning, you know, they're only going to work with what your body has naturally.
Generally speaking there, well, first of all, the actual vitamins and minerals, yeah. PQQ, PQQ, coenzyme Q10,
okay,
carnitine, lipoic acid. Those are all, I tend to call those ones, pseudo vitamins, yeah, because if they're not in your body, you get disease-like effects. And like if you just have none, you pretty much die. Right. And in these situations, if you replenish your body, the stuff goes away. And it would have the classification of a vitamin if the body didn't synthesize it. And because the body synthesizes enough to survive, and there's no like, just you can't accidentally have a coenzyme Q10 deficiency if you just eat a healthy diet. You'd have to like actually force it with statins.
Sure. So there's a pretty known awareness that everyone's going to have different levels of different nootropic or different neurotransmitters, right? So, you know, I may have high levels of GABA and low levels of acetylcholine. You may have high levels of dopamine and low levels of serotonin. So obviously there needs to be some individualization of these products and the realization that influencing them at some level has a tremendous potential to influence your psychological state and your physiological state. So, you know, getting into understanding that acetylcholine tends to be the one associated with learning. It tends to be this one associated with perhaps memory formation. Dopamine is going to be kind of a neural drive neurotransmitter. Talk about a little bit about which are your favorite dopamine agonists, and if there are any that you recommend, and if not, why not?
Okay, first I want to clarify, like you already know this, but just for all the listeners, the reason we say tend to when it comes to a lot of these neurotransmitters is that there is no single emotion in the body related to one neurotransmitter. Mm-hmm. It's always a union of like 5 or 10 of them working in concert towards one effect. But when we say tend, it's because of past studies where if that one neurotransmitter goes up, an effect happens and is fairly reliable. Like in regards to that whole neural drive thing and the reward pathway, acetylcholine is involved in the reward pathway. It's why nicotine is a bit like quite addictive as a, you know, just in cigarettes. But despite it being involved in reward pathways, we associate and say dopamine tends to be involved in reward pathways because, well, first of all, that's the first thing we learned about dopamine. And if you just force an increase in dopamine, you get that stuff. Mm-hmm. But back to the topic of what I'd recommend. There isn't too much I'd recommend for inducing dopamine. I have to mention L-DOPA from the plant Macuna pruriens, but you don't necessarily need the plant. It's just L-DOPA. And it's probably the start. Like if you're looking into things to increase dopamine, at least from a research perspective, you have to start there. Because all it is when you have the entire pathway of dopamine synthesis, there is a rate limit. And that rate limit comes before L-DOPA. So by putting L-DOPA in your mouth, you circumvent that rate limit and can force a slight increase in dopamine. Right. It is perhaps the, I don't want to say purest, the simplest yet effective way to increase dopamine to the point where it is in, used in Parkinson's disease every now and then, just because dopamine deficiency, pop in some L-DOPA with some carbidopa, everything's good-ish, as good as we can get
it. So any insights and research on, you know, tyrosine, N-acetyltyrosine, phenylalanine, and how they may influence the dopamine pathways?
So I don't have much commentary on N-acetyl-L-tyrosine. It's kind of like the Alkar thing where people report different and weird effects and the studies aren't really there. So I don't know what's happening with NALT, but, you know, some people use it. But for tyrosine in general, it's before the rate limit. So there will be a certain point where the body's like, okay, we don't want any more dopamine, stop making it.
So you,
and then it goes, it looks at the conversion specifically between L-tyrosine and L-DOPA. Mm-hmm. And that's where it stops it. That's where it just says, so okay, no more.
That may have more of an effect like one of these pseudovitamins you're referring to, which kind of enhances your body's natural ability to make what it's capable of and stops there.
Yeah, it has a built-in safety buffer.
Right.
And L-DOPA says, screw the safety buffer, we're doing it anyways.
Right.
So if you want to force a potent effect, L-DOPA is more likely to do that. If you want a safety buffer, it's probably better to go tyrosine and NALT.
Or perhaps a low-level combination of the two.
Potentially.
Yeah. So talking about acetylcholine then, so, you know, pre-workout guys, if you're trying to drive up performance, the basic two you're concerned with are dopamine and acetylcholine. And, you know, driving up dopamine is going to make you feel great. It's going to be that, like you said, that reward hormone reward neurotransmitter. Acetylcholine is going to be that one that maybe allows you to stay a little more focused, maybe get better muscular contractions. What are your opinions and thoughts on best things to influence acetylcholine?
The basic one that most research has been going into in the past few years is alpha-GPC. Yeah. Like it started out like it was actually the first study I saw them use bench throws in to assess power, which I thought was really clever. Like they literally just had people go on a Smith machine, do a bench press and say, hurl it as far as you mm-hmm. can. And that's how they assess power. And alpha-GPC helped with that. And then it like died down for about 5 years where there wasn't much studies. And now it's starting to get another resurgence. And it just seems to actually, first of all, be an ergogenic. It's one of the few things that is getting evidence where in a pre-workout, it works. But beyond that, it basically just gets to the brain, gives you some choline. If the body wants to make acetylcholine, it can. It's not going to force anything. And also the GP in alpha GPC could also potentially be a nootropic effect just by helping the actual structure of neurons. There isn't much evidence on that. It's just a happy little side effect of taking alpha GPC compared to another choline source like CDP choline or just choline by chartrate, which I would not recommend for the brain.
Great. So yeah, I was gonna ask, is there any research on comparing those acetylcholine compared against GPC as far as absorption and the ability to actually get choline levels elevated in the brain?
So both CDP choline and alpha GPC are confirmed to affect the brain, but neither, they haven't really gone head to head yet, if that makes sense. Like the studies on them are quite different, just hard to compare them. Choline bitartrate, however, does not have a thing on it to help it get to the brain, and because of that, the liver just eats it all. So it's a healthy liver compound. It's just not a nootropic.
Understood. So maybe a healthy liver compound, exactly, right? So people realizing that choline is a necessary additive to liver health, or a necessary ingredient to liver health. So moving on to your favorite ingredient, Bacopa. Tell me about that and why you love it.
The reason I love it is because it's just so drastically different from all the other nootropics out there. We see the other nootropics, and I'm talking from a research standpoint, mind you. The other ones are just like, oh, we had one study in 10 people, and they kind of said they were happy, and then all of a sudden it's being sold for like $40 a month. Like, it just seems way too, like, whatever the opposite of hesitant is, eager. Like, people see one study, they want to sell it, and then people are like, oh, I got to try this. Maybe this will be the next holy grail. And it's not. It never is. But people try it anyways. Bacopa, on the other hand, has over a dozen human studies on it right now. It takes about a month or so to work, and it just works reliably. It's not fancy. It's not over-the-top potent. It just subtly but reliably improves memory. That's it.
That's brilliant, though. I mean, what more can we ask for? Have you seen any research that shows benefits of inositol or inositol, however you want to pronounce that, benefiting brain health and neurotransmitter function?
I have not actually. I haven't looked into inositol specifically for the brain. Just think about what inositol is. You could argue that it has those pseudovitamin-like motifs I mentioned earlier. So if it did get studies showing that it benefited the brain, I would not be that surprised. But overall, I haven't really seen much evidence on it, so no comment.
Awesome. Have you seen any, or can you talk about the benefits of methylated B vitamins in benefiting the brain? There's a huge trend right now, and I see the high price point on B vitamins, and I'm wondering what you know about B vitamins influencing brain function and cognitive performance.
So I'm a little bit skeptical over B vitamins. I do know that B12 in particular, the first time you take a high dose of B12, it just jazzes you right out, and then it just kind of doesn't do that anymore. I don't know why that it does it. I haven't seen any reason why it should. But generally speaking, if you happen to have B vitamins in a supplement, like from a manufacturer's perspective, it costs them 5 cents to put the B vitamins in. Better safe than sorry.
It doesn't. In fact, looking at the methylated B vitamins, there's actually the most expensive ingredients in most supplements, and you'll see that as you get into more formulations. Like the price is ridiculous on methylated Bs and B6 and B12. B5.
Have you looked into the tocotrienols for vitamin E?
No, I haven't. Are they crazy?
It's like an extra $37 a month just for the tocotrienols. Yeah. It's disgusting. Yeah.
I'm sure eventually they'll come up with a new way of synthesizing like they have with most other things. Teocrine started as a really expensive ingredient, and now it's much more reasonable. So like everything, its synthesis is the limiting factor. Hey guys, I interrupt the podcast to bring you a message from our sponsor, ATP Labs. And our feature product of the week is Estro Control, which has quickly become one of our best selling products, both to men and women. Even though it looks pink and you may think it's a predominantly female product, I actually recommend it to a lot of my male clients. We're exposed to so many environmental estrogens, so many xenoestrogens in our drinking water, in plastic bottles, and anything we eat that's plastic can expose our body to potentially dangerous xenoestrogens. And Estro control is a proven formula to help our body start to eliminate these xenoestrogens. So another way you can do it is with infrared saunas, but I recommend adding estro control for anybody who's noticing potentially decreased testosterone ratios, potentially accumulated additional fat around your bottom and your lower half and your thighs. That can often be indicative of elevated estrogen. So if you're someone who experiences some of those symptoms, head over to ATP Lab right now. Check that out. Estro Control is the product. And because you're cool and because I love you, use the code BEN10 and get 10% off. And if you sign up for their VIP newsletter, you will also get free shipping. So that's super cool. 10% and free shipping. Sign up for the newsletter. Back to the episode. Enjoy. Talk about caffeine. So, you know, we talked about caffeine and theanine being a really beneficial synergy. Talk about that a little bit and what your thoughts are on caffeine and is it a useful and effective, I'm pretty sure we know it's a useful and effective enhancement aid, but talk about it a little bit.
Okay, I actually, I take a certain approach to caffeine where like before you take it or if you are taking it right now, you need to make a decision. Caffeine is either an anti-sleep aid that like will improve long-term health or it's a potent stimulant. You cannot have the best of both worlds. Caffeine has what is called an insurmountable tolerance. Normally, if you take 5 milligrams of something, you get tolerant to it. You can take 15 milligrams, no problem. And then once you get used to 15 milligrams, you can take 20 milligrams. Mm-hmm. Caffeine is outright opposite. As soon as you get used to caffeine, no more amount of caffeine will give you the benefits lost.
Interesting.
So when I talk about the benefits lost, it's because when you block the adenosine receptors, you will do the anti-sleep effects. But initially, you also, there's a bit of cross-signaling into the dopamine pathway, and then you signal dopaminergic-like effects. So the very first time you ever take caffeine, you will feel the effects of increased dopamine. And that's the pathway that has the insurmountable tolerance. The anti-sleep effects, and I guess some health effects secondary to blocking adenosine, will always exist, but that dopamine branch will be completely shut down. So when it comes on a practical side of things, if you have coffee each and every day, like especially if you're like having 200 milligrams or so, it's not going to be a dopamine supplement. It just never will again, unless you take a break for like a month and then have some studies use about 500 to 600 milligrams once or twice a week before a workout. And when you do this, it can reliably increase power output.
Interesting. That's really interesting research. I'd love to see that. I mean, if you have access to that, I'd love to have you send that over. We can attach it in the show notes of the podcast because I think people will be really interested because caffeine is obviously so widely used and it's almost like, you know, if you don't use caffeine, you're kind of an anomaly. So very, very interesting area of topic. Any other supplements you think we should touch on? You know, you mentioned huperzine very quickly, and I think that's a really important one to mention. What have you seen as far as its effects and benefits in the brain?
It's an effective but inherently risky supplement. And I'm not talking major health risks, but just like something you shouldn't be doing. And if you happen to do it for months on end, probably not the best idea. Basically, it increases acetylcholine. But it does this by preventing the breakdown, by inhibiting the enzyme called acetylcholinesterase. Mm-hmm. And that inherently is not a problem. The problem is that huperzine A has about a 13-hour half-life. And when we mean half-life, it's basically you have X amount of your body. Mm-hmm. And then once that time is hit, now you have half of X amount sort of thing, which means that when you take a single dose of huperzine A a day, it will be in your body for 24 hours until you take the next dose. And when you force an effect on an enzyme or protein, you want to give the body some downtime to recover. With huperzine A, you don't. So if you're doing like, let's say, a study session that lasts for 12 hours or whatever, it'd be a great compound to consider. But then it'd be something that you have to consciously not consume the next day or maybe even the day after that.
Interesting. Good to know.
Yeah, because otherwise you run the risk of teaching your brain to get rid of more acetylcholine than it should. Hmm. Like that's just how the brain adapts. Like the drug will force an increase in acetylcholine, but what the drug giveth, the drug taketh away. The body will adapt to assume that is the new normal state. And then when the drug is taken away, you have an accelerated rate of acetylcholine depletion resulting in like relatively less acetylcholine.
Interesting. And the research
and
shows
then eventually
that.
The body will no- sorry?
Research shows that?
It does not show it with acetylcholine in particular, but it's a well-known motif when it comes to drugs. Like it's the saying, what the drug giveth, the drug taketh away. Serotonin. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Like, I'd say about 80 to 90% of the benefits you get on a drug, you will experience the opposite during withdrawal.
Right.
Like, so if something makes you feel like elated and happy, it's probably going to make you irritated when you're not taking it. If something makes you sleepy, you're not going to be able to sleep once you go off it, that sort of thing.
Interesting.
And the more potent the drug is, generally speaking, the more potent the side effects. It doesn't apply to every single drug, but it's a good rule of thumb.
So now, you know, I think no nootropic conversation would be complete without getting into the racetam group. So, you know, talking about the mechanism, talking about what they are, how they work, and the efficacy and safety.
Okay, so racetams are popular because one molecule, p-racetam, was pretty much the start of all nootropics. It was designed specifically with the tenets of nootropics in mind to provide a subtle but beneficial boost with no side effects. And p-racetam is pretty good. There actually isn't good human evidence to suggest that p-racetam increases memory formation. There's like a few studies here and there, a lot of them from the 70s, but overall, that's not where studies are. They're more mechanistic studies and safety studies. So if you want to test out nootropics, it's a good starting point. But beyond that, the word racetam refers to the structure of the molecule. And a bunch of other racetams have been made, and a lot of them act quite differently. It is initially thought that they all worked through what is called AMPA receptor modulation. Basically, AMPA is one of the glutamate receptors. And when it gets activated, it will cause the neuron to do stuff that at the end of the day is conducive to memory formation. And the receptor modulation is basically a term that says it makes the receptor work better, but at the same time doesn't force it to be overactive to the point of damaging the neuron. And so it's seen as sort of a holy grail, but by the nature of that mechanism, something that induces an effect but has a sort of built-in safety limit when the receptor just stops signaling, they're not as potent as one would think.
Is it legal, or is it one of those gray areas?
So racetams are legal for a single person to have in their possession. However, they are not technically dietary supplements. They are more regulated as pharmaceuticals. So it's the companies that will be punished if they're caught selling these racetams.
Interesting.
So if you have, like, let's say, a supplier of racetam, know that the FDA can swoop in at any time and just say, here's a fine, you shouldn't be selling that, do it again, you're in jail, sort of thing. So it's fine for the consumer to buy them, but it's a risk for the companies.
Mm-hmm. Now, getting into other things like oxyracetam and phenylparacetam, how are they different, and how do they work, and better, worse, any experience?
So I've taken a few of them. The only one that's majorly different would be phenylparacetam, because people report that as a very potent stimulant. Like, it should probably be treated more like a light amphetamine than an actual nootropic in my mind. Beyond that, piracetam, I've never had any effects with it. My favorite is aniracetam. It just helps with verbal fluency, which, as you may have realized at this point in the podcast, I'm not so good with words. So aniracetam does help with that.
I think you're doing great.
Yeah. But beyond that, I don't know, a lot of them are hit and miss, but p-racetam, aniracetam, and oxyracetam are the three that tend to have the most evidence. When you get into other racetams, they have like much less. Like, I heard some people taking something called coluracetam, and when I tried to research it, there's literally 8 studies, 2 of them are in rats, 6 are in vitro. And yet people think it's a good idea to just shove it in their face and hope for the best. you see that a lot with nootropics, especially the more research-based ones, like the ones with acronyms and the ones that aren't actually plants and all that. People are willing to sell them and consume them way more readily than you think a brain-boosting community would.
So let's pull this all together with what would a safe and effective nootropic stack look like for you?
So it would start by just assessing any dietary insufficiencies and alleviating them. Like, if you have like next to no magnesium in your diet, or your zinc intake is low or whatever, alleviate those things first, because the problems you perceive in your brain may just because your body is not nourished. Once that is out of the way and like you have a good routine down. Like, your sleep isn't that screwed up. You have some exercise. Your diet's okay. I would start with a Bacopa Monnieri. Take that for a month, see how it works. And more importantly, I would just take some self-reflection and realize that when you study, eventually you won't be able to. There is something that happens in your brain that will stop you from studying. Maybe you lose focus. Maybe you focus way too much and you get a headache. There's something that is getting in your way of learning, and that's what you should target. Like, if you lose focus and like start looking at everything else, then you may want to take something like L-theanine. If you want to pair it with a stimulant, that's the caffeine-theanine combination there. If like ginkgo biloba evidence.
Do you recommend caffeine theanine at a 4-to-1 or a 2-to-1 ratio? What's the typical recommendation for that?
Generally speaking, it's at a 2-to-1 ratio to twice as much L-theanine as it is to caffeine. But if you make it a 1-to-1 ratio, that's more for like stimulation and exercise purposes. Okay. 2-to-1 is a good place to start though.
Okay. And you were moving on to another ingredient?
Oh, I was just throwing out examples because ginkgo biloba has some evidence of improving memory, but it seems to be more visually associated. So if you are learning and like you always like look at graphs, look at pictures and all that, maybe that's the one to consider. But my general advice to people who want to get into nootropics, start with Bacopa, start with just getting good healthy habits and alleviating any vitamin and mineral deficiencies. And at that point, just go from there. Just learn, like experiment a little bit. Take one new compound like every month, see what works for you personally. And that's important because, again, to harken back to the first thing I mentioned in the podcast, we don't know much about the human brain. And if you want to benefit your body, you need to find what works for you. So don't just shove a bunch of stuff in your face. Take one single thing, record how it works on paper, and after a while, you'll figure out what works for you.
Sure. One of the greatest recommendations that I make to customers and clients is going through the Braverman test. So there's a book called The Edge Effect by Eric Braverman that allows you to kind of do a subjective assessment to determine neurotransmitter levels. So you can determine if you're high in GABA, low in serotonin, high in acetylcholine, low in dopamine, as an example. And then, I'm really low in dopamine. Maybe I want to look at augmenting one of those pathways. And that's really one of the ways to kind of start, rather than just blindly guessing and throwing in supplements to see how they work. So an example, I'm usually pretty deficient in acetylcholine. You know, I've always been a guy who trained 1 to 2 times a day. I'm usually reading a book or two a week. I'm usually trying to perform, at a relatively high level in my business environment, be able to function and articulate myself like a human being on podcasts. So acetylcholine is a very important thing for me, and I'm ripping through it very, very quickly. That's a good place for people to start as far as a kind of quantitative assessment. If you guys are out there curious as to how you should start supplementing with things to influence neurotransmitters. Curtis, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you enlightening us here with all this great information on research and data, revolving the nootropic trend. And I look forward to discussing more with you.
Okay. Till we see you again.
Cool, man. Thank you.